Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. Cancer. Not something you want to study, but when faced with a diagnosis, your choice is to study or take the advice of your doctor, who you may like, but is it right for you? It's hard to challenge your doctor to give you access to studies, rates of false positives, etc., etc., and all this while you're frightened. For the last 30 years, Ralph W. Moss, Ph.D., has independently evaluated cancer treatments, both conventional and not. His Moss Reports has been a tool for delivering personalized information to patients. His best-selling book, Cancer Therapy, The Independent Consumer's Guide to Non-Toxic Treatment and Prevention, is the subject of today's show. Join me in this hour as we take a critical look at cancer therapies. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thanks, Lena. Does health insurance stress you out? Feel insecure about medical care? A recent study of bankruptcies discovered that over half were caused by medical costs breaking the back of family finances. 3 out of 4 of the families that went bust had insurance when their medical troubles started. They got sick, couldn't work, lost their job, and with it their insurance and the medical bills piled up. In our current system, health insurance is tied to employment. People keep jobs they hate and leave jobs they love for health insurance. Increasingly, what they get in return is paltry. With premiums, co-payments, and deductibles, the emergency room has become the primary care for too many people. Our current system is stressful, insecure, and stupid. Last Friday, the San Francisco Chronicle's business page, of all places, carried an article by columnist Dan Lazarus discussing State Senator Sheila Kuehl's single-payer health insurance legislation. If her legislation becomes law, it will provide universal coverage and save money. You'll be able to get care when you need it. You won't have to think about how you're going to pay for it. This will be good for your health in more than the obvious way. Insecurity is a major stressor. Helplessness is a major stressor. As Lena has discussed so many times on this show, stress promotes illness and in some cases causes it outright. Supporting Senator Kuehl's single-payer plan does you good in two ways. Corporations and government have colluded over the last 30 years to make jobs less secure. The Bush administration is currently doing all it can to make retirement less secure. Now we have an opportunity to make healthcare more secure. Supporting single payer also does you good by affirming that you are not helpless. You can do something, like calling on your state senator and assembly representative to support Senator Kuehl. And while you're at it, tell them you oppose the Universal Health Care Act of 2005, a bipartisan brew concocted by Joe Nation, a Democrat from San Rafael, and Keith Richman, a Republican from Granada Hills in Southern California. This piece of work tinkers with the existing system to make insurance available to everyone, but the way it works is to require you to buy health insurance. If you don't, they will take the premiums from you. Brilliant. You can't afford insurance? Then you get punished. Is it just me, or is this a really stupid idea? Senator Kuehl's proposal is Senate Bill 921, the California Health Insurance Reliability Act. Find out about it on the web at healthcareforall.org or call 888-442-4255. That's 888-442-4255 and healthcareforall.org on the web. Less stupidity, more security, less stress, better health. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and a health strategies advisor who works with me on the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. In addition to his work on the newsletter, he works with people making healthcare decisions. You can reach him by going to his website, inchargeofyourhealth.com, or calling 707-874-1496. Let me introduce my guest and get into our topic of cancer therapies. Ralph W. Moss, Ph.D., is an internationally known medical writer who has written 11 books and 3 film documentaries, mostly on the question of cancer research and treatment. The former science writer and assistant director of public affairs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York from 1974 to 1977. For 30 years, Moss has independently evaluated the claims of various cancer treatments, conventional and non-conventional, and he currently directs the Moss Reports, which are detailed written reports on 200-plus varieties of cancer diagnosis. These are personalized to people's needs. We're very lucky to have him today. Welcome to you, Ralph Moss.
Thank you. Pleasure to be there.
It's really fun to finally have you on the air with me. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Good.
So I'm very pleased that you joined us. This month's issue of the Townsend Letter contains an article on the war on cancer titled In God We Trust, All Others Show Data, in which you take on the published statistics which are supposed to make the consumer feel like industrial medicine is making progress in this so-called war.
Yes.
Is there progress?
Well, basically, no. I mean, I think it's quite astonishing that it's been now, I lose track, but 34 years since the war on cancer was launched. And if you look at the numbers of cancers that can be cured through standard measures, they're essentially the same as the list that the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute presented to the Congress in the late 1960s. So I'm sure that, you know, more testicular cancers are being cured, but some of those were being cured back in late 60s, early 70s. And I think there's been improvement in the treatment of childhood leukemia, which, again, was already the progress had been made in the late 60s and early 70s, and there's been refinement on that, Hodgkin's disease, and we could name a few others. But I think what's really more of news is the fact that the common kinds of carcinomas that are afflicting and killing most people in the industrialized world, there's been remarkably little progress made. And I think maybe some nibbling around the edges of some of them, but really no particular breakthrough. And we're talking about, we're now up to something like $6.2 billion a year in the budget for the National Cancer Institute. And many other billions spent in, you know, by the other government agencies, the American Cancer Society. So, no, I certainly don't think it's been a success, and I don't think that we're making that official medicine, industrial medicine, if you will, has been making very much progress at all in this war on cancer.
One of the things that you cite as a manipulation of the information is the 5-year survival rate as a marker. You want to explain why that's not such a good marker, after all?
Well, you know, even people who should know better in the government and American Cancer Society are always pointing to improvement in 5-year survival, and there's no doubt that those numbers have gone up. But that's a reflection of the earlier diagnosis of the disease, is what they call a lead time bias, so that if you have somebody who, let's say, has a tumor growing at a certain rate and you find that tumor earlier, the person is going to, quote-unquote, live longer from the time of diagnosis. They might die at exactly the same time that they would have died otherwise, but the earlier you find the tumor, without there being any actual increase in lifespan, the higher goes the figure for the time that they survived from the time of the diagnosis. And this is something known to every biostatistician that I've ever spoken to. It's talked about and joked about and so forth, but it's conveniently forgotten, and I must say that I've been astonished by some of the comments that have come out of the National Cancer Institute of late, claiming that this is a reliable figure for judging the progress in the war on cancer. It's just not the case. And it's a joke, really, to people who are, you know, who specialize in analysis of statistics relating to cancer.
Well, maybe a joke on the inside, but in my practice consulting with individuals, it's not a joke when a doc, an oncologist or a regular family prac is scaring their patient into a conventional treatment plan.
Right.
I've seen people who have, I've given them things to read, they've done the studying, they know what they feel on the inside, they know what their value system is, and they still proceed with a potentially cancer-causing treatment. So in other words, for cancer, there are many treatments which in fact cause other cancers. So how do consumers protect? I mean, you've written over 500 pages here in this book on cancer therapy, which discusses an enormous number of different tacts that can be taken, and all the research and all the sightings are present in the book, and you have newsletters and you have all this information from people. But when faced with a doctor telling you that if you don't do what they tell you to do, you will die.
Yeah.
How do you advise people to face this down when there's someone coming at you like that?
Right, and it's a very good question because it really, you know, that's where they get people on the emotional level, and we're all prone to that. Cancer's still a very scary word and most dreaded disease, maybe most dreaded condition we could have. But what I usually do is advise people to, first of all, inform themselves of the actual state of the science in regard to their particular diagnosis. The government has assembled a pretty useful database called the PDQ. It stands for Physicians Data Query, but it's actually gone beyond, way beyond physicians, since it's now available to all, anybody who has access to the internet. And it's at the website www.cancer.gov, G-O-V. And it's a pretty good resource in that if you click on the professional side of it, not the patient side, it tells you what the state of the art is in terms of recommendations for treatment for all the four major stages, five stages of many different kinds of cancer. So I often have sort of entered a dispute between a patient and a doctor in terms of my advocacy role or my advisory role by just saying, well, let's all be working from the same page, which in this case is the government's own words and database. And the professional side of that database is pretty accurate. The reason I kind of hedge this and hesitate is because I've been kind of dismayed by the lack of their failure to keep it up to date. So some of it seems to just sort of stop at about 2000 or 2001. But aside from that, they're pretty realistic about what treatment can and cannot do, and more often than not, what the actual medical record shows, and one could supplement this with PubMed, which is the main medical database listings, is that these conventional treatments are just not proven to extend the life of people with cancer, especially with advanced cancer, for most kinds of cancers that people get. So, you know, let's all agree to base ourselves on science and on what the scientific record actually shows. What happens is that oftentimes doctors will try to shift the, subtly or not, shift the debate away from actual patient benefit to what are called surrogate markers, which is to say shrinkage of tumor. Shrinkage of tumor may be important in some situations where it's impinging on a tumor's impinging on a nerve, for instance. But by and large, the size of the tumor does not have anything to do with the survival of the patient.
Well, there's another even more important question here, which let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Ralph W. Moss, PhD. His book, Cancer Therapy, The Independent Consumer's Guide to Non-Toxic Treatment and Prevention, is a thank you gift for those of you who join us during this hour at 5:10 848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. Feel free to call anytime during the hour and join us. I will give you some pledging times. The bigger question is, how dangerous is cancer, and can patients live with some forms of cancer instead of going on a war against it that may end their lives early? I mean, in fact, most of the most conventional, most aggressive cancer therapies haven't really had a good clinical trials. They've never been held to the high standards that some of the newer, less invasive therapies like Stanislav Brzezinski's antineoplastins, for instance, have been held to in terms of trials. So the bigger question, I think, for somebody to ask themselves when they're faced with a diagnosis, especially if it's a diagnosis that they received during this kind of constant screening that doctors are doing that may, in fact, call into notice cancers that may never progress to anything, that are even really clearly cancer. They're sort of a precancerous condition. So how dangerous is cancer, and are all cancers dangerous, and can patients live with some of these forms instead of killing themselves, fighting it?
Good question. I agree with you. A lot of pseudo-cancers are being discovered. Gilbert Welch, who you may have read his book.
Yes, I interviewed him, yes.
Did you? I was going to say,
should you be tested for cancer?
Exactly.
Maybe not, and this is why.
Pretty astounding.
Mm-hmm. He's an insider, too.
He is an insider, right, at Dartmouth professor. But he's truthful, and so what he's showing is that a great many pseudo-cancers, not really cancers, are being, quote-unquote, diagnosed, found incidentally to test or through massive screening, and those truly may never progress to cancer, but everybody is then treated as if it were cancer. And I would say probably most of the people who have very early stage breast cancers and very early stage prostate, if you consider, I mean, they're not even cancers really, but a lot of the DCIS, ductal carcinomas in situ, will not progress, and the LCIS is basically a marker for risk of cancer, but the LCIS, the lobular carcinoma in situ, isn't even a marker for lobular carcinoma. It's really a marker for ductal carcinoma. So it's not really a condition in and of itself, and yet people who get those diagnoses feel that they have breast cancer and oftentimes take, radical actions like mastectomies. And of course, that then fuels the numbers of cured cancer patients. So part of the reason that these statistics of cures have been going up is because, people who never would have been diagnosed before with prostate cancer are suddenly diagnosed because of an elevated prostate-specific antigen test, and enter the roles of cancer patients. And I think, what Welch shows in his book is that, I mean, the implication that I get from it is that we can sort of have as much cancer as we'd like in our society, because just about everybody is eventually going to test positive for some cancer, quote-unquote cancer, of one kind or another. And once you get into it, it's really fascinating that many of these, there's no way to determine really whether a small growth that is found is really cancer or not cancer. It's kind of an ambiguous, thing. The clearest cut cases would be tumors that were discovered early that really were cancerous growths, and if you can get to them early, logically, it seems logical that if you can operate on them, cut them out, or possibly irradiate them, the tumor won't come back and it won't spread in most of the cases. So there is a case to be made for early treatment, but whether you should go, as he points out, whether you should go out aggressively looking for those in the population, it doesn't really make much difference in terms of the actual survival, the numbers of people who are going to be, quote-unquote, saved by doing that.
Well, I also see people in my practice who are medical victims who have been treated for cancers, and the treatments almost killed them.
Yes.
And, in fact, it doesn't look as though they needed the treatments. For the particular cancers. I mean, John Goffman's work on radiation is you have to know that that's your only option if you're going to take a risk of giving yourself a different cancer later from the radiation.
And a great many people who are treated for, you know, treatable cancers like Hodgkin's disease, wind up with a second cancer later on, which is not curable generally. And that's a common occurrence. I forget the percentage, but it's high. It's a high percent, maybe 30, maybe as high as 30%, wind up with these so-called second cancers. And then that's really tragic. So the fact that radiation and chemotherapy are themselves often carcinogenic and certainly highly destructive to the immune system, you know, this has been known for a long time. I mean, it was shown at Stanford after many, many years of study that giving radiation prophylactically to women who have had surgery on their breast, if it was, especially if it was to the left breast, damaged the heart and the immune system and the whole cardiovascular system to such an extent that it wiped out any benefit that might have been seen by, you know, preventing the recurrence of the cancer. And this has been seen over and over again, that the iatrogenic effects of the treatment sort of wipe out, if not overwhelm, the beneficial effect of not having the cancer recur, so that most of these treatments really are dead end. They don't really add anything, but instead create other problems, such as heart disease, that are even harder to deal with.
So here's what we know. What we know is that the war on cancer is not working, that the aggressive war on cancer is not producing an effect. In fact, if you read the book Critical Condition, the Steele and Bartlett book, what you see is that the life expectancy in the U.S. is 29th among all the other countries. So all our expensive technologies are not working. Patients are being pushed into therapies for cancers from early. The early screenings are causing people to be treated too early for cancers that may not be cancer and risking illness later on. So what might we be learning from this? One of the things that I think we're learning is that if you look at the way cancer treatments are designed, and if you look at even some of these cancer treatments that are less invasive, mm-hmm. what they seem to be going after, and you tell me if I've got a full list here, is inflammation, anti-angiogenesis, in other words, preventing mm-hmm. these cancers from setting up a blood supply, mm-hmm. And this may have to do with vascular issues like taking anticoagulants and things like that, and then boosting the natural defenses of the body using tumor necrosing factor, things that increase these tumor necrosing factor issues that fight the cancer naturally, or Brzezinski's antineoplastins, which are replications of the body's own defense against cancer. Have I left out, I'm trying to figure out, like, is that a good list of what we're trying to do? Reduce inflammation, avoid getting blood flow to the tumor, boosting the natural defenses. Is there something I'm missing?
Well, I think that there are some therapies that maybe directly target aberrant cells, cancer cells. I would think of pancreatic enzymes in that category. And I believe that, you know, they're not maybe not ultimate cures, but there are certain very ancient natural ways of dealing with cancer that have been developed in other countries that are totally neglected or greatly neglected in the United States. And I'm thinking specifically of heat therapy, hypothermia, and light therapy, phototherapy or photodynamic therapy, which are quite well, and electric therapy, quite well developed in countries like China and to a certain extent in Germany, but pretty much unknown, except out, you know, in certain specialized academic centers where it's usually hard to get into their clinical trial programs. So, you know, I think that there is some potential there, and there's just general nonspecific. I mean, there's different kinds of immune therapy, but I'm not sure you probably mentioned that, but things like mistletoe that are so widely used in Germany that they're not even controversial anymore, and there's something like maybe 20 different mistletoe products available that I can think of in Germany. And here in the United States, we had one product, ISCAR, and after 9/11, the FDA informed the company, Valeda, that produces it in Germany, that they wanted to do a top-to-bottom inspection of the factory and wouldn't allow it back into the United States unless they did that. You know, it's kind of an absurdity. And now it's been over, 2.5 years, I think. 2,000 people who were on that treatment were basically left high and dry, having to apply now for compassionate use, which they don't always get for the treatment. So, you know, there are other avenues available. And the results with hypothermia in particular have been generally very, very good. Hypothermia allows you to reduce the dose of chemotherapy or of radiation therapy. It basically, on any particular day, hypothermia heat can sort of be half of the radiation. So the particular dose given on any day is of radiation, ionizing radiation, would be half what it normally would be. And that's and it doubles the effectiveness. Is more important, more to the point.
Mm-hmm.
And these are facts that are attested to even in major medical textbooks like the Perez and Brady Principles and Practice of Radiation Oncology, which is so-called Bible of radiation therapy. It's very clear from the statements given there that, you know, everybody knows this. They know this about hypothermia, but it's just heat. It doesn't involve, you know, very expensive, phenomenally expensive, exotic, sexy machinery. It's a very simple technique that just about anybody in private practice could do.
Right, so, which is probably why it's not being discussed quite as much. There is, you know, I mean, Samuel Epstein's work. About how embedded the cancer establishment is with pharmaceutical companies and technologies is well known. We need to take a short break. We will be right back with our interview with Ralph Moss. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Ralph W. Moss, Ph.D., journalist and cancer journalist, science writer for the last 30 years, and one of the main people who's been a voice in the darkness for consumers. His book, Cancer Therapy, The Independent Consumer's Guide to Non-Toxic Treatment and Prevention. If you miss parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can either go to the website, www.yourownhealthandfitness.com, or you can call 707-874-2772. Back to our interview. So we've been talking about the fact that there is good news in terms of cancer therapies, which are reducing the toxicity of treatment. We've also been talking about the fact that people may not need to expose themselves to early treatment. One of the things that's really impressive about the book is that it's filled with advice about specific nutrients. And they all work sort of in this way that I was saying, reducing inflammation, protecting, keeping blood flow from going to a tumor site, boosting natural defenses. And there are some surprises and some not surprises. One of the things that's not surprising is that antioxidant therapy is remarkably useful for protecting the body, both if somebody's being treated for cancer and also protecting you from getting cancer. So the usual antioxidants, the common ones, vitamin C, vitamin A, and vitamin E, which have been recently attacked in the conventional media, are in fact remarkably cancer protective and also protect the body. Now, one of the things that's interesting, and then we can go on from there, there's minerals, which are amazing, is that, you know, a lot of people are cautioned against using supplements. And, you know, this is back to, does the cancer establishment contribute to doctors' ignorance of this? Or, you know, because, I mean, as I said, cancer patients are often, oh, don't use this while you're being treated.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two different issues there. One of them is, should people, when you look at epidemiological studies, you can see huge differences in cancer rates among different populations. Just crossing the border from the U.S. into Mexico, the cancer rate falls in half.
Wow.
And the difference between a country like Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and let's say the high, really high cancer rate countries like Hungary, and Denmark, and Ukraine is one-third the cancer deaths in the so-called third world countries or poor countries compared to these European countries. So clearly there are some environmental factors at work. I would discount the genetic component because
thank you.
Pretty well known that when populations migrate from a low cancer incidence to a higher cancer incidence, their cancer rates go up, and eventually within a couple of generations they have the same rates as pretty much as the rest of the population, except to the extent that they maintain their original cultural diet that they had and what lifestyle that they had. But I'm sure that this is fundamentally environmental, and of the environmental, I would say food is the biggest factor. You can see huge differences depending on the intake of specific nutrients. But the biggest, if you want to look at the sort of the big picture, I would say there's not much question that the intake of antioxidants and other phytonutrients in plants and in fruits and vegetables and herbs in the food is very well established in the science, and very few would give you a debate about that. What you've got some debate about is the impact of dietary supplements. And I'm sort of two minds on this because, I, as a person, I don't particularly like to take supplements, and I think it's sort of silly to, since you're going to be eating and you have to make your...
Ooh, I so disagree with you.
Okay, well,
boy. You're saying that because you're privy to all this research and you write about it in your book, and you're like, how can you read about this and not take these things?
Why can't you get the...
Because it's not in the food. You'd have to eat about 12 times the amount of food that you normally can eat.
Some things you do need to.
Okay, well, we can agree to disagree on this. And I'm shocked because your book is just full of advice on this.
But I mean, vitamin E and selenium.
Incidentally, I hope this isn't going to keep people from getting your book, because they've been listening to the show for a long time and they know my stance. But I should say that your book is filled with information on how protective these nutrients are, despite whether or not you like taking them.
There's no question the nutrients are protective. The question is whether it's better to get them from your food or to get them from your food.
I think that the research shows that you can't get the levels that you need. I mean, you yourself talk about needing, I mean, among other things that was a surprise, is the amount of calcium that's cancer protective. And we're not talking about 200 or 300 milligrams from your food, let alone people with allergies to milk who maybe can't get it from milk. But you're talking about 800 milligrams a day or something to protect you from cancer. Anyway, excuse me, I'm sorry to go.
That were done, you know, that's how they did the studies. But in any case,
yeah,
that's one issue. And the other issue is whether to take antioxidants when you're undergoing cancer therapy.
Yeah.
And there's a very big debate over that. And I would say, in general, it is true that there is a lack of good clinical data on that question. But if you look at the studies, and there are probably about 150 of them, if you take all told, you know, laboratory work and as well as some clinical work, the overwhelming preponderance of the data supports the synergistic activity of antioxidants and chemotherapy or radiation. There is a fear on a theoretical level that since radiation and some chemotherapy works by generating free radicals, that's the mechanism by which it's thought to work, that you would undo that effect by taking the antioxidants. I don't believe that's true. I understand the theoretical basis of the concern, but it is just a theoretical concern. And in practice, it does not undermine. And we have some instances. There was a clinical trial in India that I believe was initiated by Kedar Prasad, who is a researcher at the University of Colorado, and you might want to, if you haven't already, you might want to talk to him someday, which showed no harmful interfering effect for vitamin E and other vitamins when given along with chemotherapy. I don't know of a clinical study that has ever shown any interference, to be honest, and only a very few test tube studies. So if you're going to have to make a decision, and patients do have to make a decision, why decide to forbid the concurrent use of antioxidants when all the scientific data is saying that they don't interfere and that they reduce the side effects in many cases, many very, very harmful side effects and serious side effects of chemotherapy. And yet that's what is the general policy of conventional American oncologists, I would say 95% of them, is to caution their patients not to take any antioxidants while they're taking treatment. I mean, to extend this to the point of absurdity, they would have to ban all fruits, fresh fruits and vegetables, which can be very high in antioxidants, remarkably high in some cases. I've only known one doctor who has advocated that cancer patients not get any fresh food or any fruits and vegetables while they're getting their treatment. Most of the others wouldn't dare. They would just look like such fools. But the patients don't know this. You know, they don't know this data. And my answer, to, you know, when patients tell me this is, well, ask the doctor for the proof. Where's the proof that there's any interference, as opposed to the many studies that show either a beneficial effect or no harmful effect or synergistic effect. So,
okay.
You know, well, that's my position.
Yeah, I get it.
If we be data-driven, let's go with...
Let's look at the data. Well, to that end, I'm going to have to let you go and give people an opportunity to get your book, because it is filled with the data, in fact, that they can use to actually talk back to their doctors, which is what I think we're asking them to do to some extent, is to stand up for themselves and use data as a way to do that. So I want to thank you for your work. Dr. Ralph W. Moss, PhD, journalist and author of Cancer Therapy, The Independent Consumer's Guide to Non-Toxic Treatment and Prevention. It's filled with information about vitamins, minerals, herbs, diets, immune boosters, and less toxic drugs, and in fact, some of the new pioneers on the forefront, like Brzezinski and Gonzalez, that we've had on the show. So thank you so much for your work.
You're
continue to do that.
If anybody's interested in getting my free newsletter, you might want to, or maybe I could tell them where to get it.
Go ahead, just quickly.
Yeah. Cancerdecisions.com.
Cancerdecisions.com.
And there's a free weekly newsletter.
Great. Thank you so much, Ralph
W.
You're
quite welcome. Thanks for having
Moss.
Me.
You're very welcome. Okay. Bye-bye for now. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com. You can also find information on subscribing to the newsletter. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Eddie Pay. And remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom. Thank you, all of you. See you next week.